First, thanks to the Dean for that introduction, in which he spells out my expertise in metaphysics and in particular philosophies of language, logic and maths. I'm going to talk to you about epistemology in which I have no expertise at all. The reason for that I'll try and explain by actually starting in a moment to talk about and remember Michael Dummett and explain how I got into this particular aspect of epistemology. But also, Lisa is obliged. Lisa is obliged to give me thanks in a moment, but I thought I'd get my thanks in first for her graciously accepting the invitation to give the vote of thanks. I'd also like to thank the Platform Party for making the time to be here. I've got to know a lot of the Platform Party quite well through my work in the union, where we sit around for hours trying to bang out agreements. So perhaps it's no surprise to them that I'm interested philosophically in agreement and disagreement. And perhaps no surprise too, that I focus on disagreement. Let me also thank the organizers of this event, which takes a huge amount of organizing, the people in the marketing department, and in particular, Jolene Steenkamp. My family, many of whom have flown many miles to be here and to make this an extra special occasion. Thank you, all of you. And to you, thanks for turning out to a lecture which I know that you know is going to be of no use to you in your next essay. Okay, and so to work. Disagreement with epistemic significance, inaugural lecture. I'm going to stop doing that now. Let me start by talking about, as I said, this man, Michael Dummett, who died recently, died just after Christmas last year. This is completely beside the point of the lecture, but I wanted to start with Dummett because I do feel the need to remember the man. He was a great man and a great philosopher. And describing the main trends of his work will give you an impression of the sorts of questions I've spent the last 20 years thinking about. An ancient problem in philosophy is the nature of representation and the relation of representation to reality. One way of thinking about at least an aspect of that problem is to think about, well, what makes a representation accurate? What makes it an accurate reflection of reality? How do we use representations to represent reality, to interpret reality to ourselves? And in a way, there's two broad responses. There's a realist response, which simply says that a representation is accurate when it reflects reality and reality's out there. Okay, that gets objected to in a long tradition of philosophy by people who think, well, that reply is completely empty. To say that something is accurate when it represents reality is simply in echoing, in other words, what accuracy is. It's not explaining accuracy in more interesting terms. And secondly, and partly, maybe this is partly the reason why it's empty, there's no check on that. Our only access to reality is by representing it. So we can't check whether our representations accurately reflect reality. So accuracy should be something we can check up on. So what we can check up on is only the relationship of one representation to another. And if you think about it, think about forming a new belief. What you tend to do is test whether that belief fits with your other beliefs. Does it cohere with the other beliefs? Is it a consequence of the other beliefs? Or is it in some way in tension with them? Do I chuck it out? So what you're doing is comparing one representation with other representations. And that gives rise, those sorts of thought give rise to a long tradition in philosophy of anti-realism. Reality is now thought of almost as a system of representations. It's not independent of those representations. That's a set of questions that Michael Dummett came to focus on. The problem with that tradition, there's a host of interesting questions there, but they tend not to get pursued profitably. One side seems to talk past the other. The reason is that it's hard to understand what the realist is saying, simply because to say accuracy is reflecting reality seems kind of empty. And the anti-realist position seems often daft and implausible. It's saying we construct reality out of our representations. Dummett's thought was to say that, our most important mark of accuracy is the notion of truth. Viewed like that, we can now come up with, firstly, neat and relatively definite characterizations of what realism and anti-realism are. The realist holds that whatever we say or think, as long as it's definite, is made true by reality. Is made either true or false by reality. So any definite assertion, any definite thought is either true or false. You can't think anything that fails to be either true or false. The anti-realist, on the other hand, thinks that we can't make that assumption. Okay, we aren't entitled to the assumption that there is a reality independent of our thought and talk, which simply makes whatever we say or think true or false. So all the anti-realist is doing is trying to draw back from that assumption. So on the one hand, you have the realist trying to make sense of a certain notion of truth. There's a definite challenge. And on the other hand, you have the anti-realist saying we need to get by without making a certain assumption that all our thought and talk is definitely either true or false. So it makes each position relatively clear. Secondly, in bringing in the notion of truth, it links the whole debate to developments in logic and formal semantics occurring towards the end of the 19th century and then the whole way through the 20th century. So a whole load of technical machinery in logic and in justifying logic becomes available to us to pursue those questions. And finally, it makes anti-realism seem like something of a plausible position and not a daft position where we're saying that, according to anti-realism, we construct reality out of representations. Okay, all the anti-realist is doing is drawing back from what seems a natural assumption that all our thought and talk is definitely either true or false. What Dummett then went on to do is to develop an ingenious argument to try and show that anti-realism must be right. Realism can't be the way to go, because if realism were right, if a language were governed by a realist notion of truth, then that language would be neither learnable nor something we could use to communicate. Okay, since we suppose that our language is one which can be learnt and used to communicate, we can't have a realist notion of truth. Okay, those arguments are quite long and technical and involved, and I'm not going to talk about them now. Let me come to disagreement. This is just a little bit of autobiography. So most of my research is tackling these issues in the realism and anti-realism debate. Disagreement enters into that debate partly anyway through the work of my ex-teacher Crispin Wright, who had the idea that we could mark out whether or not we wanted to be realists or not by a particular subject matter by thinking about disagreement and whether we tolerate disagreement in that subject matter. So, for instance, I think I did try to tell a joke a little while ago. Some of you might have found that funny, okay, others not. And presumably no fault attaches to you whether you found it funny or not. So you disagree about whether or not the joke was funny, but neither of you is at fault. Okay, neither of you is at fault because there's no comic fact of the matter. Reality doesn't provide comic facts. So about the comic and perhaps about judgments of taste when it comes to whether or not something's delicious, we tend to be anti-realists. On the other hand, when we're talking about ordinary middle-sized objects like the whereabouts of my bicycle, okay, we don't tolerate disagreement. Okay, if you think my bicycle is in my office and I think it's not, at least one of us is at fault. Okay, so we seem to be realists. We think as a matter of fact about where my bicycle is. So that's what I was thinking about. And trying to pursue that question, I had to try and be a little more clear about what a disagreement is. But found that hard work. And around about that time, a book was published called Disagreement, and I thought that was going to solve my problem. It was going to tell me at least what other people thought disagreements were. Turned out it was no help at all. It was addressing a completely different problem. What I was interested in, you might say, is the metaphysics of disagreement. The book was interested in the epistemological significance of disagreement. So I got wrapped up in this problem, and that's the problem I want to talk about tonight. So what is disagreement? Well, here we have disagreement embodied in President Obama and Reverend Wright. This is for the cyclists in the audience. We're not going to probe what disagreement is, and in fact, it's a virtue of the discussion of the epistemology that we can do it without being precise about the nature of disagreement. So a disagreement, we can assume, is just some sort of tension or conflict between individuals' viewpoints. Okay. Let me set up my problem. Okay, what happens now is I'm going to do what 90% of academic papers do, is I'm going to set out the problem, I'm going to tell you what other people say about it, I'm going to tell you why they're all wrong, then I'm going to tell you what I think the right answer is and why I'm right, and then I'm going to look at one possible consequence of my solution. Okay, so I want to set up the problem by telling a bit of a story, but I think it's not simply a story. I think it's a story that captures the essence of the problem. So the scene is this. Okay, I'm ill, and I'm interested in finding a diagnosis to my condition and consult a couple of doctors who I've imaginatively called Doctors X and Y. And the important thing about the case at this point is that doctors X and Y are, as it were, on a par, kind of symmetrically placed, both with respect to the evidence. Okay, they both have access to exactly the same evidence. They've had similar experience of the condition. They've had similar training, etc., etc. Okay, but each comes up with a different verdict. Okay, this happens all the time. If it doesn't happen with doctors, it certainly happens with builders. So the question is, what ought I to believe? So what's the epistemically responsible thing for me to do? I've tried to avoid technical terminology, but epistemic and epistemological crop up the whole time. When I say epistemic, I mean relating to knowledge, and when I say epistemology, I mean relating to the theory of knowledge. Okay. Well, it seems clear that I've got no better reason to believe Dr. X over Dr. Y. Okay, they're each exactly similarly placed, and the position is entirely symmetrical. So what I should do is reserve judgment. I don't know what I'm suffering from, given the evidence of Drs. X and Y's opinions. Okay, that seems all pretty straightforward and mundane. It quickly becomes problematic, though, when you think about Drs. X and Y. Drs. X and Y should be able to echo my reasoning exactly. Why are they in a different position? Okay, Dr. X should be able to look at the bare fact that there's two medical experts, each of equivalent qualifications and expertise, and they come up with different views. Okay, so Dr. X should realize that in fact, there's no better reason for preferring her opinion over Dr. Y's, and vice versa for Dr. Y. So perhaps they should, the epistemically responsible thing for them to do, not only for me to do, is to reserve judgment. Okay. Well, that doesn't seem too bad until you realize that that sort of reasoning if it can be run in this case, it can be echoed in every case of disagreement. So whenever there's disagreement, the right response is to reserve your opinion. Okay, so what I'm going to call this position moderation, and the point about moderation is that it claims that this sort of reasoning, which I'm never going to say is wrong, should be globalized. We should always run with this sort of reasoning, and every time we encounter disagreement, the right response is to reserve judgment. Okay, why is that so problematic? Okay, well, because, so this is moderation. What it's going to entail is that in certain subjects, such as philosophy, where controversy abounds, okay, nobody would be entitled to any opinion at all. Okay, so, well, we seem quickly also to run into paradox, because if reserving judgment is the right response to controversy, okay, actually the question of whether moderation is a valid philosophical view is itself a controversial view. Okay, I'm in the process of arguing against moderation. Other people are arguing against moderation. There's equally good philosophers arguing in favour of moderation. So if moderation was the right view, then surely the right response should be to reserve judgments in moderation. And that just leads to a horrible intellectual cramp. There doesn't seem to be anything any sense you can make of it. What's happening here is that what we're really concerned about is having different inquirers and thinking about inquirers having to defer to other inquirers. So you should defer to epistemic superiors. You should reserve judgment when you disagree with epistemic peers. And then you get this problem. Okay, the cartoonist didn't have this problem in mind, but it equates pretty well. So I don't think the cartoonist thought of the guy standing on the right of the picture as an epistemic expert, but I'm taking him to be an epistemic expert. And he stands up and has the view that we need more dissenting opinions. Okay, and the response is, we agree 100%, absolutely, sir. Okay, no dissension at all. The point is, I think it makes a serious point, which is, it might well be that this epistemic authority's view is wrong, okay, but if moderation was right, this would be the right scenario, in which case the epistemic authority's view is not only wrong, it's self-defeating. Okay, but it doesn't seem right to think that it's self-defeating for an epistemic to superior to think that it would be good if more people had different opinions. Okay, so that's my problem. Okay, our problem is moderation. The solution is resoluteness. Okay, and so most of the time I'm going to be discussing ways of being resolute. I should say that these terms, moderation and resoluteness, are borrowed from Catherine Elgin. So the question is how to be resolute, and I'm going to be discussing people who advocate resoluteness. And in a way, it's no surprise that since we've got a lot of opinionated writers contributing to a controversial issue, most of them are going to be resolute theorists. So what we want is some way for each character to privilege your own view. Okay, so what we don't want to say that moderation is wrong, we just don't want to say that it's not always right. Okay, I mean, one of the reasons why we don't want to say moderation is wrong is that in some cases it seems like the right response. Okay, so for instance, if we're both adding up a long list of numbers and we come up with different results and we're each as competent as the other arithmetically, it seems like the right response should be to reserve judgment. Or in other cases, we each see a little animal scuttle into the bush and I think it's a Hraesbok, you think it's a Steenbok, and the light might not be too good. And if we're each equally competent, again, we should reserve judgment. Okay. In that case, I don't know whether it was a Hraesbok or a Steenbok. Okay, so what we want to do is to allow moderation to be appropriate, at least on some occasions. Okay, so if we're interested in being resolute, we need to think a little bit more about how the argument for moderation gets going so that we can question its assumptions. First assumption is that it depends on discerning a symmetry between oneself and the other inquirer. Okay, the situation is set up so that we're epistemic peers. Okay, not only are we epistemic peers, we ought to know that we're epistemic peers. Okay, if we don't know that we're epistemic peers, the symmetry has no relevance to us. Okay, so we need to be able to, there needs to be a symmetry, and we need to be able to discern that symmetry. We then need to think that that symmetry is relevant to our marshalling of the evidence in favour of or against the particular view. Okay, so it needs to figure in our intellectual economy, how we decide what the right thing to believe is. Okay, and then, and this is an assumption that might not have occurred to you, but it is an assumption that we treat the whole process of reasoning as issuing in an epistemic norm, namely a view about what we ought to believe. Okay, so the argument for moderation tells us that in this case, what we ought to do is to reserve judgment. Okay, so if you're going to be a resolute theorist, it seems that you've got three options, which correspond to denying each of those assumptions. So you can deny the availability of the symmetry, so either deny that there is a symmetry, or deny that you can know it, or you can deny that the symmetry is relevant in how you decide what you ought to believe, or you can deny that the argument develops an epistemic norm. In other words, deny that it tells you what you ought to believe. Okay, so here's the landscape as I see it. I'm not sure if this complicated diagram helps make things clearer, but having constructed it and being so proud of it, I couldn't bear to take it out. And I'm also told by my students that any paper with this sort of flow chart of all the positions is great, so I wanted to write a great paper. So what we have here is, so as I said, we're just discussing resoluteness. So we start off with resoluteness at the top, and then we have our three options. We can either reject the availability of the symmetry, or we can reject the fact that we need to take the symmetry into account in constructing our beliefs, or, as I said, we can deny that there's an epistemic norm, that nothing in this tells us what we ought to believe. Okay, so let's think about the position where we reject the availability of the symmetry. On the one hand, we might deny that the situation can be known to be symmetrical. And there we've got one character, Van Inwagen, who, or at least one character that I'm going to discuss, who says that we can't know that the situation is symmetrical because there are always private ingredients of evidence. Okay, there's private ingredients in the evidence that you construct for your beliefs which you can't share with me, and vice versa. So we can never know that the situation is symmetrical because there's always these inaccessible private ingredients of evidence. Okay, on the other leg of that option, we have the option of trying to make out a special status of for one's own beliefs. Okay, so you deny that there is a symmetry because one's own beliefs have some kind of special status. And on the one hand there, we have Rafe Wedgwood, and there's a story that goes with it, but I'll forbear telling you that, who claims that moral intuitions play a role in forming new beliefs. So he's interested here in forming moral beliefs, and his point is that we base our moral beliefs on our own moral intuitions. He's not saying that moral intuitions can't be shared, but he's saying because you base them on your own moral intuitions, your own beliefs have a special status. Then the BW is me. Okay, and this position I call humble chauvinism. It's chauvinist because I'm going to say that my beliefs have a special status. Okay, but it's humble because I want to temper that, and we'll come to that in a moment. Okay, so now we go up to rejecting the epistemological significance of the symmetry. Now that might be, it seems, either a consequence of the nature of the inquirers. Okay, and on that option we have Thomaton, who claims that it has no significance because inquirers in controversial areas are unreliable. Okay, and there's no epistemological interest in disagreements between unreliable investigators. You'd precisely think that unreliable investigators would disagree. Okay, so the fact that there's unreliability here shows that this is of no epistemological significance. On the other hand, we might focus on the nature of the dispute, and here we have Coney, who says that, well, we have what we might call permissive disputes, in which we tolerate disagreement. So disagreement doesn't indicate any rational fault in either inquirer. Okay, so that's like the case that I mentioned a while ago with the comic and judgments about taste. Then there's a final option, which is rejecting the idea that there's an epistemological norm. Okay, and this is the only person I've found who advocates this view is Catherine Elgin, who says that, look, beliefs, unlike actions, aren't under deliberate control. We don't choose what we believe. Okay, so it's census thinking that there's a norm governing what we ought to believe. There can be norms governing what we ought to do, but not norms governing what we ought to believe. Okay, we simply set about looking at evidence, constructing arguments, and we come up with a view. Okay, so those are the views. Let me briefly say what I think is wrong with each of them, not just because it's fun to disagree with people, but because I think there's morals to the reasons why each of them is, in my view, wrong. Okay, so actually I'm not sure there's too much to learn from Van Inbog, so I'll start there. I mean, it just seems to me, and this might be a Wittgensteinian prejudice, that it makes no sense to think that there's private ingredients of evidence. Evidence is the sort of thing that can be shared, can be discussed, can be put into arguments. So you can't have private ingredients of evidence. And if there were, then they would be limited, I think, to very particular cases. So it wouldn't be a solution to the problem as it crops up in a range of different areas. Wedgwood. Well, his account only applies to moral disagreement, so it's difficult to see how it would apply outside that case. And I mean, it seems that the underlying problem is quite general in controversial areas and isn't one, and if it's going to have a solution, it's going to have a solution which applies across all of those areas. It doesn't seem like we've got different problems in different areas. And although I think there's something right about him focusing on the business of forming beliefs, he hasn't explained quite why it's important for us to form beliefs based on our own moral intuitions. My head of department is a professional moral philosopher, and his moral intuitions are likely to be a lot more tutored than mine, so why shouldn't I defer to his moral judgments? Humble chauvinism isn't wrong, so I won't say why it's wrong, and we'll meet it in a moment. Flamerton's view, that inquiries in these areas are unreliable, seems like the counsel of desperation. I mean, he has a particular argument for thinking that philosophers are unreliable. But surely the right reaction to discovering that you're an unreliable inquirer is to give up inquiry. What's the point if you're unreliable? It was my decision to give up physics because I discovered that I was an unreliable inquirer in physics, and that decision was supported by a number of professors in the department. And Farmington might say I found my way into philosophy and joined the ranks of the unreliable, but I just find that a difficult position to swallow. Coney's view is interesting but highly controversial. I mean, it's controversial to claim that that you can have two parties who disagree but aren't at fault, even in these particular cases such as the comic and judgments about taste. And massively controversial to think that that's the case in subjects like philosophy and other academic disciplines. Okay. Much as I respect my colleagues, if they disagree with me, I think they're making a mistake. And finally, Catherine Elgin's view that beliefs aren't under deliberate control seems to miss its mark. There's things you can do in order to regulate your beliefs. Okay, so you should look at the appropriate evidence, you should look at good arguments, and if you don't do those things, you can be criticized. So her simply saying that there's no epistemic norm because beliefs aren't under deliberate control, that seems wrong. What's really getting her is that she's not convinced by the argument for moderation. If she were convinced by the argument for moderation, she would defer to other experts, she would reserve judgment when her peers disagree with her. And if you think about it, and going back to physics again, that is what we do. I mean, physicists are apparently completely unashamed in asking you to believe the most incredible things. They ask us to believe that light has properties of both waves and particles. That seems like a contradiction to me, but they're the authorities. I defer to them. The argument for moderation seems right there. And if I didn't defer to them, it seems to me I ought to be criticized. So there is an epistemic norm. Okay, so we meet humble chauvinism. Let me just recap what I think are the lessons for those critiques of the other positions. I think what we want in a solution is a solution which isn't restricted to a single subject matter. We don't want a solution for moral judgments, a different solution for judgments about taste. We want a solution that applies across the board to all different subject matters. We also want an account which isn't premised on some hugely controversial assumption about the nature of disagreement and the nature of rationality. On the other hand, it does seem that the problem has something to do with the way we form beliefs. So I think there is something right in what Wedgwood is getting at, but it needs to be seen more generally and needs to be explained why that's relevant. And I think, although I wasn't very generous to Fumerton, I think there is some link between reliability and the epistemic significance of disagreement. Like I said, disagreement between completely unreliable investigators is of no epistemic significance at all. And finally, as I keep repeating, we don't want to say moderation is always wrong. It's globalizing moderation that's so pernicious. Okay, so as I summarize here, we don't want to say that there's a fatal reasoning in the argument for moderation. And we also want to find, if we're going to be resolute and somehow privilege our own views, so if we're going to be chauvinist in a sense, I think we also need to, it would be irrational for us to blind ourselves to the evidence of other people's opinions. So we need some way of incorporating that evidence. Okay, so we need to temper our chauvinism. So we need, in some sense, to be humble. Okay, so this is what we want, having primed you for all of that. So what we want is a way of recognizing the evidence of other people's view without that contaminating what I'm calling the original interpretation of the original evidence. So for instance, if we're interested in the question of whether God exists, what we want to do is to find a way of allowing us to make that decision on the basis of arguments for and against the existence of God. Okay, and then bring in the evidence of others' views in some other way. Okay, but the view that we come to has to be based on a direct engagement with those arguments. Okay, and that section of the paper I'll call reliability. And then, as I said, we don't want to deny moderation. We want to allow that moderation is the right way to go on some cases at least. So we want to have some account of when it's right to protect one's engagement with the evidence from other inquirers' views. Okay, so two legs of the solution to go. Okay, so I want you to try this thought experiment, which is merely supposed to be suggestive. So suppose that you believe that P. So P could be anything. So suppose you believe that God exists, or if you like, suppose you believe that God doesn't exist. Okay, now you're told that there's some character X who's very unreliable and who also believes P. Okay, how does that alter your confidence in the original belief? Well, seemingly hardly at all. Okay, after all, X is very unreliable. Even though X is very unreliable, the fact that somebody else shares your beliefs shouldn't count against your beliefs, but given that they're very unreliable, it can't really count for your belief either. Okay, now, suppose I tell you that you're X, and ask you the same question: how does this alter your confidence in the original belief? Surely that changes your confidence drastically. Okay, you suddenly unnerved because you know that you've made up your mind, but you're not a reliable inquirer. You in all likelihood, got it wrong. What does that suggest? It suggests that one doesn't simply garner the evidence of in a kind of objective way of there are these inquirers of such and such reliability who hold these views. Okay? And that's what my second opinion case suggests. Okay? I asked Dr. X to put himself in the position of somebody asking for the second opinion, and he thinks of his own view as just another piece of evidence. We've got Dr. X's opinion and Dr. Y's opinion. So it suggests that there's some sleight of hand in insisting that he does that. So we don't simply throw in the evidence altogether, because the evidence of the form which relates to your own belief has some sort of special status. And finally, this is, I think, the important handle that it gives us on the problem, is that it's saying that when we look at the evidence of others' beliefs that can impact on one's own belief, not by dictating a different way of arriving at that belief, but by affecting one's own sense of one's own reliability. So it can affect one's confidence in the belief, not the way you form the belief. Okay, so that's just a suggestion. I want to apply it to our second opinion case. Okay, so remember that we have these epistemic peers who disagree. Okay, well, first fact is that it's pretty unlikely that two highly reliable inquirers disagree. Okay, and that likelihood vanishes to nothing when our inquirers are infallible. Infallible inquirers are bound to agree. So it gets increasingly unlikely that you're going to get a disagreement as inquirers get more and more reliable. So if you're faced with a disagreement, one way which might appear, given your view that both inquirers are very reliable, so it might appear very unlikely, one way to mitigate that unlikelihood is to revise your sense of their reliability. So you might think, well, we've got a disagreement here, so these characters, it's likely that these characters aren't as reliable as I might have taken them to be. Okay, so if we go back to Doctors X and Y, okay, it might be that what Dr. X says is that the fact that I've got a disagreement with somebody who I took to be very reliable shows that perhaps neither of us is as reliable as we initially supposed. Okay, that would be another way of incorporating that bit of evidence, and it's a way which doesn't affect their engagement with the medical evidence itself. All it's doing is affecting their confidence in their medical opinion. Okay, and it wouldn't push them into a situation of reserving their judgment. They would still cling to their belief. They would just lessen their confidence in it. And I mean, the reason why you might see that because suppose that they're 90% reliable. If you've got inquirers who are 90% reliable, the chances that they disagree are close to 20%. So although it's unlikely, it's not that unlikely. So there's no need for them to go overboard and withdraw their judgments completely. Okay, and as I said, importantly, it doesn't involve any alteration in their original interpretation of the original evidence. Okay, they still engage with the medical evidence just as they did before. Okay, so that's my suggestion on how we incorporate the evidence of others, other inquirers' differing beliefs. Okay, so what we need to do now is go back to the other leg of the program and to describe at least some set of cases where it's appropriate to use that way of modifying your beliefs in light of others' opinions and perhaps disagreement. So I have these two cases now. Okay, so we've had one second opinion case, we've now got two third opinion cases. Here, the difference between the second opinion case and this is that here we don't know how reliable doctors X and Y are, nor whether they're as reliable as one another. So in the first case, I've consulted doctors X and Y, they come up with different views, so I go off and consult a third doctor, Dr. Z. In case two, I consult doctors X and Y, again I'm given conflicting views, but I don't bother paying for a third opinion. Instead, I chat to my cycling pal and ask him his view about which verdict I should go with. The point here is that hopefully Dr. Z and my cycling pal will engage with the evidence in quite different ways. What I expect of Dr. Z and what I'm paying for is for Dr. Z to engage with the medical evidence again and to deliver yet another medical opinion. In other words, an opinion which is explanatorily justified by the medical evidence. Okay, I'm not expecting that of my cycling pal. It's the last thing I want of my cycling pal. My cycling pal knows nothing about medicine. His opinion on the medical evidence would be worthless. But his opinion on medical reputation is great. Okay, given the 1,000 unnatural shocks that cycling flesh is heir to, cyclists know a lot about the reputations of doctors. So my cycling pal is exactly the right person to say whether I should trust Dr. X over Dr. Y. Okay, so what's the difference between Dr. Z and my cycling pal? Well, what I want to say is that Dr. Z is, or at least has been put in the position of being, an engaged inquirer. That is, an inquirer who engages with the evidence and tries to construct an explanation of a particular state of affairs. Okay, my cycling pal doesn't do that and can't do that. Okay, but he's interested in the truth. Okay, so he's a mere information seeker. Or, not to be derogatory, he's an information seeker. Okay, but he's not interested in explanations or in coming up with a view which is explanatorily justified. And the point here is that the fact that Dr. X believes something, okay, might be an indication that that something is true, but it's no indication of why it's true. So in the written version of this paper, I have a discussion of different sort of indicators. Indicators that something is true and indicators of why something is true. And I guess there could be a lot of work into trying to talk about which bits of evidence fall in which category, but I'm not going to do that. For me, all I need to say is that people's judgments are not indicators why something is true. They're simply indicators that something is true. And as such, they can be incorporated in engaged inquirers' deliberations, but incorporated only to the extent of modifying one's confidence in one's view, which, as I said before, should be based on one's original interpretation of the original evidence. Okay, so to summarise, so we've got engaged inquirers and mere information seekers. Engaged inquirers seek explanatory reasons. Information seekers simply want the truth. They're not interested in why it's true. Engaged inquirers can protect their inquiries from the beliefs that others hold, okay, because that evidence isn't explanatory. But importantly, they're not irrational because they don't blind themselves to that evidence. It modifies their confidence in their original view. Okay, information seekers have no motive to separate different bits of evidence into different categories. They're simply interested in where the truth is, and since indicators why something is true are also indicators that something is true, they all go into the same, all those pieces of evidence go into the same basket. Okay, nearly there. Okay, so that's my solution. I wanted to draw out a consequence, and the consequence has to do with ourselves as academics and trying to investigate in conditions of academic freedom. So, and this isn't a great cartoon, but all it's doing is picking out different stages of an academic career and pointing out at each stage that whatever work one does it within restrictions set by some academic authority. So implicitly, there's a criticism of certain academic authorities. So is there a tension in academic inquiry? So, I mean, the academic exercises a certain freedom of inquiry, yet she's expected to do that within largely university structures, which are quite hierarchical, and as I say, institute elaborate systems of authority. And so we have our echelons of academic degrees, grading schemes, prizes, academic ranks, peer review of various sorts, performance management, etc., etc. Okay. So is there a tension between that aspect of academia and the ideal of free inquiry? I'm not going to say there isn't a tension, but I'm going to say there may not be a tension. Because on the one hand, I take it to be fairly obvious that if we're academics, we're going to conceive of ourselves as engaged inquirers. So on the one hand, what we're interested in is explanatorily supported beliefs. Okay, beliefs which explain why things are true. Okay, that, and as I said, if we're going to reject moderation, delivers a certain entitlement not to defer. Okay, I don't write a paper by saying Michael Dummett is much cleverer than me, has spent much more time thinking about this problem, has talked to much cleverer people, all due respect to my colleagues, and has this view. Okay, what I do is engage with the very same issue that Michael Dummett engages with. So we have an entitlement not to defer, certainly to epistemic authorities, and most certainly not to political authorities. On the other hand, if I'm right, there is an aspect of being an engaged inquirer which involves appraisal of other inquirers. I appraise other inquirers, particularly other inquirers who disagree with me, in order to form some sense of my own reliability and of how confident I can be in my own conclusions. And if that's right, it's certainly not daft. In fact, it's quite reasonable to expect that aspect of our appraisal of one another, okay, and appraisal of historical figures as well, to be institutionalized in academic structures. The test, though, of those structures is whether they enhance our role as engaged inquirers and what I like to think of as custodians of our disciplines. Okay, people who decide who are the figures who should be studied. But that, of course, leaves it open of whether the current structures of academic authority pass that test or can be justified in terms of that test. Okay. But seeing that this event marks my recent benefit from one of those structures, at least, I'm not going to probe that question anymore, at least now. Thank you for your attention.